The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back as we head into hour two. A delight to bring back my good friend, our good friend, Ed Morrissey. Among other things, Ed is the managing editor at Hot Air. He is the host of the Ed Morrissey Show, and I am privileged to serve on the Town Hall editorial board with Ed. Ed, happy Friday. Thanks for spending some of it with us today.
Happy Friday to you. Great to be with you.
You betcha. You betcha. I like it when we can connect on Fridays and kind of do a wrap-up every once in a while. So thanks for making yourself available additionally. I know how much you're working over at Hot Air and with other stuff, your own show. Actually, that point, you know, let me just – you and I are on a conference call at the beginning of the week, kind of looking at what – the big stories are, or what perhaps some of the most impactful stories are. And, you know, I was just thinking about that in respect of this week. Come Monday, it's going to be impossible to know what those could be, because gosh knows what will happen over the weekend, but also how much transpired this week. Just think about the Robert Hur testimony, which I thought was a big damn deal, and it feels like it was 6 months ago. It was 3 days ago.
Or you think about
the congressional action on TikTok. That's couldn't be farther from the news today. Yesterday it was everywhere. Today it's obviously all eyes on Georgia. It's just an amazing rate we're expected to keep up with, and it's hard to keep account of what's important. I don't know what point I'm making, except to say I hate the frenzy, but man, we're in one, aren't we?
Well, we are, and it's interesting because there are just so many different threads going on. And, of course, it's an election year, and that's sort of true in election years anyway, but this one just seems to be – there seems to be a lot more at stake. You've got one of the presumptive nominees is in the middle of four different court cases over allegations of wrongdoing. The other one seems to be having trouble thinking his way through a speech. And it's very unusual. And then, of course, you've got all of the ancillary drama. And what's happened in Georgia, you were talking about. You know, the Fannie Willis thing. What happened in Georgia is actually sort of ancillary to the allegations in the indictment. Yeah. This was allegations of misbehavior by the prosecution
that
really didn't have anything to do with the defendants, but certainly had an impact on the credibility of the prosecution down there. And the ruling that came out today was, at best, I think it can best be called a punt to the appellate court. And
do you think
was a gutless decision that the judge made clear that he just didn't have the intestinal fortitude to make the correct decision on this?
Do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's a strange thing.
Yeah, no, it is strange. Do you think it's? Do you think Fannie Willis will appeal? I mean, hard to know all the considerations going on, but I
don't think so.
Yeah, I mean, that's right, because what we have now is a delay, don't we? More than anything, we have a set.
Well,
go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, first off, she was told you either have to fire Nathan Wade, your maybe ex-boyfriend, or you have to step down yourself.
Yeah,
and I mean, this ruling was something else. Judge Scott McAfee, I read the ruling, and Judge Scott McAfee said that their behavior in court was unprofessional, that their testimony and the testimony of people who were on their side had the odor of mendacity. Yeah. And I mean, that's a direct quote. Odor of mendacity is what was actually in the ruling.
Yep.
It was described by CNN as scathing about Fannie Willis and Nathan Wade and Terrence Bradley, who initially apparently alerted the defense team to this relationship and then tried to lie during court. And McAfee more or less said, you just can't believe anything Terrence Bradley had to say.
Right.
I mean, it was obviously false testimony that he was offering.
Right.
And then at the end decided to do nothing about it except to have Fannie Willis cure the issue on her own, make her own decision as to how to cure the issue, which doesn't make any sense at all. And my best guess on that is that he was setting out the fact-finding so that when it does get to the appellate court, because clearly the defendants in, you know, Georgia v. Trump et al. Are going to appeal this.
Mm-hmm.
Fannie Willis won't because it basically let her off the hook, but the defendants will.
Yep.
And when it gets to the appellate court, they're going to look at this and say, well, Judge Mac, we wouldn't do fact-finding. We wouldn't be triers of fact, but we don't need to be because he's got the facts laid out in this ruling, and the only thing that's missing is a rational response to his conclusions, which is to remove Fannie Willis as well as Nathan Wade from this. Either way, though, removing Wade means that you got to start over with a new prosecutor. And it's not going to be Fannie Willis, because Fannie Willis is not going to be able to be in a courtroom with Judge McAfee.
Nope.
I think it was Andrew Weissman, actually, who made that point,
yep.
is that she just can't be in that courtroom because she's got no credibility.
He doesn't
now
trust her.
Him.
The judge does not trust the district attorney. That could be a headline.
Yes. So they're going to either have to hire somebody from the outside or find somebody in-house to do that, and good luck finding somebody from the outside who wants to step into this soap opera and take on a case that is most charitably described as novel, right?
Yeah.
This RICO case is absurd.
Right.
And I don't know anybody who's going to want to take this thing on at this point in time. She's going to have to assign it to an assistant district attorney if she wants to pursue it at all. And that person's really got to start not over from scratch. I mean, they've taken depositions, they've gotten different plea deals and that sort of thing, but they have to take over the case. They're going to have to go over all that material. It's going to take them months and months and months just to come up to speed on what Nathan Wade's been doing since, what is it, November of 2021?
Yeah,
I think
is
when he took this in November of 2021. So he's been at it for 2+ years. You're going to have somebody come in and catch up to 2+ years worth of work cold.
And answering to someone who is very compromised. I mean, you know, often you will find a special prosecutor, or in this case, whatever the term of art is here that they're using for him, SADA, Special Assistant District Attorney, I guess.
Right. Yeah.
You know, you can often use people of, you know, high reputation or what have you from the outside. But think about what they would be asked to be doing. They would be asked to be working under a very compromised district attorney who, by the way, does not look like it's very pleasurable to work for. I mean, I just think the goose might be cooked anyway. The judge had a lot to say about her without the reprimand or without the ultimate sanction, that she inflicted a significant appearance of impropriety that infects the prosecutorial team. His language is strong. You're right. The conclusion is a little wanting, but the language is there to say that this is not someone we can trust anymore.
Right. So, and that's assuming that she's going to stay in that position, because inevitably the Georgia State Bar is going to have to look into this.
Yes, I think
there's already
right.
been a complaint right. filed today based on her threatening Nathan Wade's then estranged wife.
That's right.
with prosecution for obstruction of justice.
Right.
For subpoenaing her in the divorce case,
right,
which is an abuse of power. It's an abuse of authority.
Yep.
And the Georgia State Bar is going to take it should really be taking a close look at that, because it's corrupt. She was clearly trying to benefit her boyfriend in a divorce where, her status as district attorney really didn't have any relevance.
Other than to try to bigfoot the case. Right.
And the reason why is because they wanted to keep the relationship quiet so that the other defendants didn't do exactly what they did.
Exactly.
I mean, the whole thing is a cover-up. It's corrupt. And so, yeah, I mean, the state attorney general might have to take a look into this. The Georgia State Bar is going to have to take a look into this. The legislature's already looking at this. I don't know how long Fannie Willis stays in that position.
You know, there was another element, too, that the judge went into, which should not go unremarked on, and that is his criticism of her outside speech. You know, that now somewhat famous speech that she gave at the church, where she was just blasting everyone for racism in attacking her, basically. And he said all that was unwarranted as well.
Right, and he said, well, you know, we can't necessarily specify who she was talking about
right.
at times, but it's clear it was much broader than just her critics, right? Meaning that
it was yes, he was making the point
that
if you were on the Trump team's, yes, right, correct.
And then he did nothing with that either.
I know.
Right?
I know.
I mean,
but
and
maybe
he said, well,
maybe
so far
he
away
thought
from jury selection. We're
maybe
so far away from jury selection.
Yeah, well, maybe he thought he didn't have to because of all the other people that are institutions that are looking at this. I mean, gosh knows why. But, you know, I could see a judge saying, okay, she's got the Bar Association, she's got the legislature, she's got an appellate court. Maybe this goose is cooked enough and I'm just going to show him the roadmap. In the way, I'll pick up on this on the other side of the break perhaps, maybe in the same way that Robert Herr in his findings kind of provided a roadmap for people to understand about the conditions of the situation with Joe Biden. Maybe. We'll see if I'm crazy on the other side. Ed Morrissey will straighten us out. Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com. HotAir.com. Must reading. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show, portions of which are brought to you by the veteran-owned Midas Gold Group, your trusted source for precious metals. Ed Morrissey is my guest. He is, among other things, the managing editor over at Hot Air, hotair.com, host of the Ed Morrissey Show. Ed, the Robert Herr's testimony in front of Congress this week was also shedding of its own certain amounts of light. And while he, too, had a lot of very strong things to say about his witness in this case, Joe Biden, target of investigation, focus of investigation, it also ended up with what you might call a null pros suggestion, a no prosecution, a no sanction. But there was enough in there to create an awful lot of fire.
Well, and just to compare the two situations,
yeah.
Herr really didn't have any ability to do anything about Joe Biden because as a special counsel under the special counsel statute as it exists at the moment, he has to comply with Department of Justice policies.
Right.
One of which, and this goes back to Watergate, and it's been formalized for the last 24 years now, is that the Department of Justice's official doctrine is that you can't indict a sitting president.
Correct.
They can't indict a sitting president because it's a violation of executive branch doctrine,
right.
basically.
Right.
And it's come up a number of times, came up during the Trump presidency, too,
yep.
came up during Bill Clinton's presidency.
Yep. Yep.
And so in the end, I mean, he wasn't going to be able to indict. He could have recommended after Biden's term of office was over that prosecutors take up and indict, but he didn't do that. He explained why, and this is a reason why it mattered that he was not recommending that that action be taken, is because he didn't think that Biden was mentally competent enough to convince a jury that he could take willful action.
Mm-hmm.
And so Robert Herr did as much as he possibly could do in making sure that the truth got out. Whereas Judge Scott McAfee in the Fannie Willis issue, laid out the facts in his ruling, but he had the authority to do much more than he did.
Yes, you're right.
And Jonathan Turley basically suggested it was cowardice, and I kind of tend to agree. I think he wants somebody else to do the dirty work because, judges at that level have to stand for election, and he drew it, challenger in this cycle.
Let me thank you for that, and let me bounce back, if I might, to the Robert Herr testimony earlier this week. We'll turn over to some goings on in the Senate yesterday that you wrote about too in a moment, but let's stay with the Robert Herr Q&A in front of the House of Representatives. Can you get inside the head of the Democrats, Ed, and tell me why is it in their interest to try and tell us something we all know with our own two eyes simply isn't true? These continued defenses of Joe Biden, of his alertness, of his acuity, of his sharp and keen spirit, step, and mind. Why is it in their interest to keep doing this? Is it because they've thrown in the hat and they know this is the only horse they have, or what? I'm mixing a lot of metaphors.
I love the mixed metaphors. It's great. I'm a big fan of mixed metaphors.
Okay. I think you can have hats and horse, yeah?
I think you can.
No horse, something. Or you'll go with
all hat, no cattle. All hat, no cattle.
Okay.
But you know, I think it's in part because they're desperate, right? They know that he's not going away, and they have to try to rehabilitate him as much as possible. Some of that is just to generate, you know, viral clips,
okay.
Right?
Yeah.
The things that their supporters can pass around on Twitter. See, you know, and I'm going to say names here, and I'm not going to be able to connect them to specific things, but like Jamie Raskin says he's exonerated.
Yeah.
You never hear Robert Herz. And I don't know if that was Raskin, so I'm again.
Oh, that was the head of the Progressive Caucus, Jayapal. Yeah, she shut him
Jayapal.
Down, right? And
yeah.
She shut him
Pramila
down
Jayapal.
When he said, "No,
yeah,
I didn't say that."
That.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Robert Herz saying, "I didn't say
right.
The word exonerate doesn't exist anywhere in this
right.
report
right.
for good reason."
Right.
But they get the viral clip, you know, without Herz's response, and the media can say, "Oh, you know, they're pushing back," and you know, it's like this. State of the Union address last week, right, is that Joe Biden was powerful, he was feisty, he was fiery, and, you know, a week later, it's very clear that nobody was impressed except for the media that was covering it. So I have a feeling that this is a deliberate manipulation just so that they can say, just so they can have some sort of alternate narrative that's percolating, because clearly, when you have this transcript where a guy who is being questioned about potential felonies that he committed and he knows about starts making vroom noises when he's talking about cars out of the blue and then tells a joke that, you know, has to do, or not a joke, but a story that has to do with a spark going down somebody's wetsuit
yeah.
and obliterating part of their genitalia,
yeah.
which has nothing to do with the question he was being asked.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's grandpa in the attic time.
Yeah.
And you have to distract from that because there's no rebutting that. It's grandpa in the attic time.
Yeah.
And so that's what they're trying to do. And I think that, you know, to the extent that they were able to do it, I think that they were pretty successful in terms of the media. But I don't think that voters are buying this at all.
I don't think anyone buys it.
It just seems self-debasing
for the Democrats to keep trying to promote this line. They, I guess, have no choice. They have put themselves into a heck of a riddle here, because I don't know that they would prefer to run the vice president of the United States. I'll tell you a story. You probably don't know this. I didn't know this until just recently. Kamala Harris, the vice president, came to Arizona last Friday and did a big, you know, I guess she's on a tour now, and did a big women's rights thing and, you know, trying to gin up interest. And, of course, using what they have in their quiver. And in this case, it's the choice life abortion debate. We have three really big Democrats in Arizona who are, you know, one of them is running for office, Ruben Gallego, congressman. One of them is the governor, Katie Hobbs. One of them is the Attorney General, Chris Mays. Guess what, Ed? None of them met with her or were in the room or went to see her speak or greet her. Not one.
That's interesting.
Yes, and it made almost no news. The only way I learned about it was one editorial writer for the Republic here mentioning it. Isn't that interesting? And the excuses were lame. The governor's excuse was, I just didn't know what was on my schedule. The Attorney General's excuse was she had to take her daughter to the airport. And Gallego's excuse was he was dealing with legislation. I mean, none of them hold water. Isn't that interesting? That's something that I think is really remarkable. I just think it's
very,
remarkable.
Very. It's very unusual. Normally, you want to be seen around
exactly
a president or vice president if you're a state-level official
yeah.
because it raises your own
you bet.
Profile.
Yep. It also says something about them clearly knowing that the vice president would take note of this, and they obviously didn't care. Usually you don't want to tick off the vice president of your own party, right? Usually.
Right.
Usually. Let me take a quick commercial break. Let's talk about what transpired in the Senate yesterday, which you also write about at Hot Air. I'm sorry, Ed. It's Friday. Give me some wide berth here. Ed Air. How do you like that? HotAir.com with Ed Morrissey. Be right back.
Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show, brought to you in part by our good friends at the veteran-owned Midas Gold Group, your trusted source for precious metals. A great source for news and commentary, HotAir.com. Ed Morrissey is their managing editor and a good friend. And my colleague at the Town Hall editorial board. Ed, in the Senate yesterday, also unprecedented action on this time on the from the podium that was occupied by the majority leader of the Senate. Your comments on that?
Yeah, I'm still stunned by this.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
We had a Senate majority leader demanding regime change in a democracy that's one of our closest allies, one of our strategic partners. I've never seen anything like that. I mean, honestly, I don't think I've ever seen anything like that. I don't think I've ever even seen Chuck Schumer ask for regime change in Iran, right? Where it's really needed. And I think that when it's been suggested that that should be American policy, Chuck Schumer has been opposed to it. I know that Chuck Schumer was very much in favor of the Iran deal, although I think that he was, I wouldn't say very much in favor. I think he ended up voting.
He has voted with that and the liftings of the various sanctions, to be sure. But yes, I think regime change is certainly one thing. Election interference might be another. That used to be something Democrats seemed to care about, election interference from countries abroad, no?
Used to be. I mean, honestly, the reason why I hesitated is because I'm still trying to wrap my mind around this. I know I've written about it. I've even cut an editorial about this.
Yeah.
I'm not even necessarily sure that that was the worst part of what Chuck Schumer had to say.
Okay.
I think the worst part was the idea. He got up there and he said, and I'm trying to remember precisely what he said, but that basically Benjamin Netanyahu was living in the past, that the world had changed on October 7th and Benjamin Netanyahu didn't realize it.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, is maybe one of the most stunning cases of projection that I've ever heard. And Joe Biden came out today and endorsed Chuck Schumer's speech, too, which was even worse in my mind.
Yes.
But the world changed on October 7th. I would say that maybe the veil lifted on October 7th. I'm not sure that the world changed.
Netanyahu, I just had the line for you. The Israeli people are being stifled right now by a governing vision that is stuck in the past. Yeah, that's
stuck in the past, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there was something about the world changing on October 7th, but it may have been separate from that.
It's part of it. I'll give it to you all. You're totally right. The Netanyahu coalition no longer fits the needs of Israel after October 7th. The world has changed radically since then, and the Israeli people are being stifled by a governing vision that is stuck in the past. No, you had it.
There you go.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The world changed, or the veil lifted at least, and the Israelis are seeing it much more clearly than American policymakers, and I would go so far as to say that the world changed, and it's Chuck Schumer and Joe Biden that are stuck in the past.
Yeah.
What's been their response this week? The two-state solution.
Right.
A two-state solution with who?
Based on elections, one presumes.
Based on elections, where?
Well, that's why I said that, because for all the election interference Chuck Schumer decided to weigh in on with regard to the Israeli polity, might there not be some emphasis on the 19th year of the four-year term of Mahmoud Abbas and the fact that the last time elections were held, that it went overwhelmingly to Hamas? I mean, what world are they living in?
Well, that was part of the problem in 2006.
Yes,
remember?
Correct.
The Israelis unilaterally withdrew from Gaza,
correct,
ended the occupation.
Yep.
Evicted, what was it, 8,000 or 9,000 Israelis from settlement in Gaza by force.
Yeah.
Forced them out. That was Ariel Sharon who did that. And then everybody was saying, we need to have elections. We need to have elections.
Boy, they had them.
And they had them, and they elected Hamas to run Gaza.
And everyone knows that Hamas would be the West Bank if Abbas would allow elections there, which he won't, right?
For that reason, he doesn't want Hamas coming into power.
Right.
So they're not going to hold elections in the West Bank. It's been longer than 17 years. I think it's been 18 years, because I think the elections in the West Bank were either 2004 or 2005.
Yeah, I think five.
Yeah.
But the point abides, he was elected to 1 4-year term then. 1 4-year term then. The math is, as most of their math, is way off. Let me take a quick break and we'll come right back. Ed Morrissey is my guest and he and I will be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Ed Morrissey, managing editor at hotair.com, is my guest, host of the Ed Morrissey Show. Ed, as long as we're on that region for a moment, you had a piece you just put up today, Breakthrough or Manipulation, Hamas Shifts Demands in New Hostage Swap Offer. Do you want to say a word about these constantly changing demands?
Yeah, well, they don't change much, right?
Right.
That's the point.
Yeah.
Basically, what they did was they just resequenced a little bit to do a hostage swap. I hate calling it a hostage swap because Hamas has hostages.
It's a prisoner-hostage exchange.
They have prisoners, yeah. Right? They've gone to trial. Right. You know, they've committed crimes. They've gone to trial. Mm-hmm. They've had a due process, and they're in prison because they've committed crimes. But they have... This time they fronted it with a swap of some of the hostages rather than just demand that the Israelis had to withdraw entirely before you could even send over lists of who's still alive.
Yeah.
So there was a concession there, but it doesn't really mean much because the other demands that were part of that same deal were the IDF then has to fully withdraw. They have to agree to what Hamas is calling a permanent ceasefire, even though Hamas has never considered any ceasefire to be permanent in any way.
Right.
I mean, these are absurd. I mean, that's what Netanyahu called them. They're absurd. And it's not just Netanyahu. I mean, just to emphasize this in terms of what Schumer was saying, it's not just Netanyahu. It's also Benny Gantz and Yoav Gallant. It's a triumvirate that's making these decisions
mm-hmm.
there. That was the cost, that was the price that Netanyahu had to pay to get a unity government after October 7th, is that he had to agree to a collaborative decision-making process. So, I mean, Schumer and I mean, it's another way in which Schumer and Biden are living in the past. This is what the strategy that Israel is following is a strategy that has a very broad consensus among Israelis and including among the opposition parties to Netanyahu. They still want him out, and when they have elections, they'll probably be able to kick him out. But for right now, they all want the same thing, which is to finish this war against Hamas and make sure that they don't have this risk going forward into the future because they have realized it's an existential risk.
You know, you would think the lesson would be learned. You and I have spent many a conference call talking about this phenomenon of prisoner exchanges or hostage prisoner exchanges or what you and I like to invoke, the Rudyard Kipling poem of Paying the Donegild. You would think the Western world would have had enough of these kinds of games, whether it's the people we let out of prison that now are running the government of Afghanistan, though we had them in our custody at one point, or whether you think about the people Israel has let out. I mean, the head of Hamas, Yahya Sinwar, was part of a swap for one Israeli. For one Israeli, he was swapped out of prison. And, you know, but for these behaviors, gosh knows if the leadership of the terrorist entities like the Taliban, like Hamas, would even be where they are today. But for the decency, kindness, or really mercy of foolishness that we engage in when we engage in this kind of behavior.
Yes. I mean, again, this is really the Israelis. It's not just – it's up until now, at least, it's been the Israelis. The Israelis were the ones that agreed to the Shalit deal,
correct,
right?
Correct, right.
I mean,
They
were the ones who – I don't know that there was any pressure on them to do a 1 to 1,024 ratio swap to get Gilad Shalit out.
And that's what it always is. It's like one or two, or in this case, one or 200 for thousands. That's what it always ends up being, it seems like. Yeah. Go ahead.
And the problem with that is that basically, you're creating a market for hostages.
That's right.
And that's exactly what happened here on October 7th. I mean, certainly they were going to go there, massacre, rape, pillage. They did all those things, but they also knew that they needed to get hostages, and they needed enough of them to try to string this thing out, to tire out the Israelis and to blunt their impulse to go on a full-scale offensive in Gaza. And, you know, based on the old math, based on the old market, they probably figured that they were in really good shape with that by getting 250 or so hostages that they could dole out in small chunks to force the Israelis to back off. But the Israelis belatedly discovered that setting that kind of a market in place is a really bad idea. And that is part of the Dana Geld that you're talking about. And they finally realized that. But again, Joe Biden and Chuck Schumer are living in the old world. They're living under the old paradigm. They don't realize the world has changed, to use Chuck Schumer's rhetoric. I just found it despicable. I found that Schumer thing to be despicable. And there's so many ways in which he is basically projecting those ills about himself. And this is one of the ways, too. Yeah.
I think that's right. But there is a political consideration at some level of this thing.
Sure.
Yeah. Do that for me, because...
So, yes.
Yeah,
I mean,
go ahead.
Obviously, if you've got... Yeah. If you've got 136 or 134, I forget what the precise number is, of hostages that are still suspected to be in Hamas's hands, you've got the families of those people, you've got the friends of those people, you've got the coworkers of those people, plus you've got people who are, let's just say, happy to be able to use that as leverage in political arguments against the prevailing consensus in Israel. Right. And that's, I mean, most of that is legitimate. I mean, if it was my sister or my brother in there, I'd be saying, "Yo, you got to do whatever you got to do to get him out of there. Do whatever you got to do to get him out of there."
I've been in so many debates on this very issue with so many of our friends, because I'm just not there, and I never have been, because it's not about that individual; it's about the country. And
In this case, and that's the reason why. Because up until now, I don't think that when this happened with Hamas, I don't think people really thought that Hamas was the existential threat.
That's correct.
Right?
That's correct.
And that's the reason why
they thought
the Israelis
it could be tamed
sort of
with economic development.
Game.
Right. To be fair, they thought it could be tamed with economic development. I mean,
and with the responsibility of governance and economic development, they thought Hamas would just be blustery, but they'd be more focused on state building.
Right.
And clearly a bad miscalculation on their part. But that's the reason why they were willing to play that game before, and now they know they can't. And that's the problem, is that the people who are heartbroken over their daughters and sons and fathers and mothers being held by Hamas, it's just horrible. It's a horrible conundrum to be in. I feel bad for everybody who's stuck in it. But this is about the survival of a country, and that's really got to be the priority for Israeli leadership.
Half a minute left. How about the political considerations here of the Democratic Party? Really kind of odd how far they have gone out on limb on this, isn't it?
I don't even understand it, because the people who are fomenting this are a very, very tiny minority. I mean, it's basically you're going to trade the whole country away for Dearborn?
Right.
It makes no sense whatsoever. They're so locked into this whole lefty, super online, demographic that they just can't see past Twitter.
Yep. But for Wales, but for Dearborn, well done, Ed Morrissey. It's always good catching up and rounding up with you, brother. I'll look forward to our chat next week, but thank you for everything.
Thank you, sir.
You betcha. Ed Morrissey, hotair.com. I will be back with a concluding thought. Don't go away. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Boy, this was really Jimmy Buffett hour, wasn't it? Portions of this show are brought to you by our good friends at YRefi. They offer up a secure investment in a collateralized portfolio where you can earn up to a 10.25% fixed rate of return, not correlated to the stock market or the Federal Reserve. With YRefi, you can turn your income on or off. You can compound it. With YRefi, there are no fees. There is no attack on principal if you ever need your money back. Of course, you get a monthly statement with no surprises. Check them out at investyrefi.com. That's invest, the letter Y, then refy.com, or give them a call at 888-YRefi-24. There's such good actors in our community. We had mentioned, I think, the last day or so, they have taken to underwrite much of our March 26th event, Fighting for Freedom, where we're bringing in Mike Gallagher, Brandon Tatum, and myself on stage March 26th. They underwrote it so that they could make the price of admission even less for you. So you can get your tickets at 960thepatriot.com. They've cut the general admission prices down dramatically. There's still VIP tickets, but do do, if you're free March 26, think of coming. I'd love to see you there. Young David would love to see you there. You can test him on vocabulary as you test Mike Gallagher, Brandon Tatum, and myself on politics and conservatism. It's going to be a fun event, and we'll look forward to doing that. We have Rabbi Alush coming in for our next hour. Young David, you got anything fun planned for the weekend? Probably won't get a chance to ask you. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. I'm going to a depression dinner tonight.
What's that? What's a depression dinner?
As much as you might think it's a bunch of people sitting around in sad faces, this was put on by the president of the Art Deco Society. It's a depression dinner where we'll all dress up in 1930s attire and eat meat jello and gravy on pieces of bread and
really
talk just about to, the economy and just how much to Franklin Roosevelt is going to do for us.
Just to commemorate that it's kind of a historical themed party?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was put on by the president of the Art Deco Society, and I was one of a select few people that were invited over to her home to participate
Oh, does that explain your tie, your funky tie?
That explains my 1930s tie and my Franklin Roosevelt pinback.
Ah, very nice. All right. I like that you do this stuff.
But while we've got a minute left, I would like to announce our weekly winner for our Fighting for Freedom ticket giveaway.
Yeah, good.
Our Fighting for Freedom ticket giveaway winner, and folks, remember, you can always email me at ddoll@salempx.com and put FFF in the title just in case you're interested in getting a comp ticket to a pair of tickets to our March 26 event. Our winner for this week is Jackie Swigart.
Nice.
So, Jackie, hope you're listening. We will contact you shortly.
Wonderful. Thank you, Young David. We'll be right back.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.